You have to ask me again what you wanted to know.
Yeah. This is tape three, side one, Hans Speier interview, April 5th, 1988. Just before we broke for lunch, we were talking about how the performance of staff members was evaluated. And you related the case of Nathan Laides and his study of the Soviet system. So there was a question of how results were presented as well that was in part a factor in evaluating staff members' performances. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'm not quite know what you imply in this little word, how.
Well, in his case, there was a very lengthy, in their view, which was essentially an unreadable study. It needed to be presented in a format that where the principal findings were readily digestible.
Yes. And this, incidentally, should not be held against the Rand administration only because he tried to get this manuscript published several times and it was rejected by various publishers because of unreadability. And it was I who got him published. I talked to a publisher personally, and I had contacts with him. That's the way it was published. And I consider this one of my minor merits in Rand that I got this book published. But he had trouble with it himself.
The other, as we're talking about the research function in relation to production and evaluation of performance, you had these biannual reviews. Now, I would assume that some research activities had a longer gestation period than others. It required a longer time to reach findings. Was it more difficult to accommodate that kind of research project in this system of evaluation?
I don't think so. I mean, frequently it happened, for example, that somebody was a member of a team and the whole project was a team project. And if that took longer, his performance, the performance of this particular member of the team would have to be evaluated somehow, and other than by looking at the written product. And even if you had the written product, you could not single out the contribution of this individual person from the report. But you had to talk to the project leader and to the division head or the division heads, who usually were relatively well informed because they kept track of what people were doing and so on, and I had to rely on a composite judgment instead of the product which was not assignable to an individual person. So, sure, it was flexibly used, this rule, and I don't even know how it was handled in cases of persons who only worked in teams. There were such. Whereas in the social science division, you had a high incidence of individual performances. We wrote books, you see, and many books were published by the social scientists. So there were various methods of doing it, and it is possible that prior to the salary review, which happened, as I said, every 6 months, either Goldie or Frank Kolbom talked to the project leaders also. Maybe they were even called in sometimes to the debate, to the discussion of the individual who was being considered. So they tried to be as responsible about it as they could be, and only in my case, in the case of the social science personnel, it was mainly a question of what have they written as individuals or in groups of two or three. Very few people wrote, well, like Laites, and Laites even did some cooperative work too. He was consulted But Brody, for instance, did not. He just was a lone wolf throughout this association with Rand. That was resented by some of the people. And there were some ugly rivalries is too much, but ugly differences of opinion about the worth of individuals Brody was one of those who was controversial, and men like Wallstetter, or the person you want to talk to, mentioned before, what was his name?
Bill Kaufman.
Bill Kaufman. You will probably get a different view from him on Brody than you might get from a few other people you might talk to.
This could lead us into a discussion of this question of interdisciplinary research.
Yes.
But I think it probably would be better to go back to the beginning and kind of outline how projects develop in the social sciences.
Yes.
And then we can tackle this question of interdisciplinary research.
Yes.
Initially you were contacted by Williams. He presented the picture of Rand to you. You were attracted to it. What did you find when you first came to Rand, and what were your thoughts about how you would go about building up a social science division at Rand?
Well, I first came to Rand as a consultant, because while Rand was still associated with Douglas Aircraft, I was not an employee. I was a consultant. And then I developed a bursitis, a very painful shoulder disease, and could not function too well. My right arm could hardly write for a while. And also, while I was waiting for Rand to become independent, Frank and others had the job to find some employment for me as a consultant. What should I do as a consultant? And I asked them, I'll consult, but what about? And so Frank, this is a typical Rand idea, said, write me a memorandum where you want the social science division to be 10 years from now. Not bad, I thought, but not so easy to do. So I wrote it. And I remember not much should, if Rand were to preserve papers, but it's a very irreverent organization as far as history is concerned. You could read it still. I don't have it anymore. I do recall that I made the statement in there, 10 years from now there will be a branch of the Social Science Division in Tokyo and another one in Paris. Because it's provincial to think that American social science done for Rand and by implication for the national security and in the national interest could be confined to the United States. And you have to. I was also later than the one who advocated very strongly that Rand should broaden its interests from the primarily SAC-oriented research, that is Strategic Air Force Command research, to include the alliance system, NATO in particular. And I made this point very strongly. So
in this memo that was look forward for 10 years.
No, and also later, when I came to Rand, I was the one who was most active in trying to persuade Frank, took some persuading, to extend the Rand project, the Project Rand activities to the alliance system at large, and not only to work not only for the strategic air force, but also for the tactical air force and for the overseas commands and so on. I mean, on subjects of interest to them and of interest to the nation as a whole. I thought that NATO was terribly important, quite apart from the fact that I knew more about NATO than about Strategic Air Command when I joined RAND. So, in a sense, I was speaking pro domo, but I felt that that was a legitimate concern on my part, that an organization that wanted to make its mark with the Air Force should not be overly specialized for SAC. You know, SAC was always confined as SAC and the Air Force. When you spoke of SAC, you meant SAC, and when you spoke of the Air Force, you meant everything but SAC at that time. So,
let me just quickly ask, when you were working as a consultant, it was understood that you were to become the head of the Social Science Division, is that correct?
Yes, as far as I can recall, I don't know. But in any case, when I came to RAND, I was asked, whether it was then or whether it was as a consultant still, I don't know, to draw up a research project. Initial research project for the Social Science Division and of the personnel and of their salaries. I was given complete freedom with respect to the personnel, the salary level at which they should come, should join RAND, and with respect to the work to be pursued by the division. And nothing, not a line of the suggestions that I made was changed by RAND, by the top management, partly because they had confidence probably and partly because it made sense to them, I don't know, and partly because they didn't know any better, because they were not experts in that field. Now, you want me to talk about the first projects, as I recall them?
Do you recall the basic thrust of what you recommended as an initial project?
Yes. I think that the there were two or three subjects that I recall that were initial projects. One was study of disaster studies, and one was the Warbo study, the bombing, warning in advance of bombing, and psychology of reaction to air war, emotional stress. This also was an early project. Then one proposal I had made was the one mentioned before already at the conference, the intelligence value of propaganda analysis, the one that Alex George worked on. I knew that Leitis wanted to work on the Soviet Union, and I also advocated very strongly that we should enlarge the RAND project with the help of the economists and the social scientists to include studies on Soviet Russia, not only on strategic bombing and weapon systems. So that's so in general. I think what I recall are the it's Russia, NATO, warning in advance of bombing, and so on. Now the Warbo study was the first collective project, on which this wasn't assigned to any individual person, but we worked as a division on it, and anybody who could possibly contribute to it, did. And there is this series of working papers that you sent me indicates that. The study itself had the following orientation or thrust, if you want to call it that. During the war, I was very much taken aback by the American and British strategy that area bombing can lead to surrender. Because I believed that you, by area bombing, you do not affect the morale of the people negatively, but you make their dependence on the government that they may hate stronger, because people need blankets to survive the climate, if it's winter, or they need work, they need food, they need water, they need barest necessities of life after bombing attack, and where can they get it but from government authorities? They can't go searching for water the way you search for wood in the woods. And you can't find jobs unless you have somebody who organizes in a completely disorganized community from a one way, and so on and so forth. So I was very much, I thought it was just a silly idea to think that by bombing raids you can get the people to overthrow a totalitarian regime. I mean, that just made no sense. I was, of nothing I was surer during the war than of that. And at the same time, I thought, incidentally, I was born out after the war by the so-called strategic bombing surveys in, conducted in Japan and in Germany, that the war production, despite the bombing, went up except for the last few months in the war. not down. I mean, the disruption came and we, mainly in the very last phase of the war, and in very large extent through tactical bombing of bridges and transportation, disruption of the transportation system, and various other things. Some oil shortage also, they didn't have enough oil for training missions and so on. Fuel shortages. But the whole idea of bombing civilians was not only distasteful to me, regardless of the fact that I was not a friend of the Germans during the war, but it was also inefficient, it seemed to me, from point of view of ending the war sooner. So, and I thought about these two combinations of making bombing more efficient and making it more humane, if you will. I thought this, if it were only possible, to find a way of bombing, strategic bombing, that would not kill so many civilians. It would be better. But how to do it without cutting into the guts of the Air Force? After all, they are in the business of throwing bombs in war time. So I thought one way of doing it would be to warn the civilian population that raids would be coming, but not warn, let's say, Berlin, if Berlin was going to be bombed, but warn Munich, Berlin, Vienna, and I don't know, some other city, four or five, and say, one of you will be bombed the day after tomorrow, or between the day after tomorrow and the day later, and so make it a little uncertain. But, and those of you who want to escape this should leave the city. That would lead to disruption without bombing of civilian activities, would lead to saving lives, and in that sense be more humane, as much as this was followed, and it would be followed if it turns out that this was the new strategy, and so on. So we try to investigate this and try to square the circle of making a more humane bombing more interesting to the Air Force, because it would be more efficient than the inhumane bombing of unannounced targets, you see? That was the whole idea. Not a bad idea, I think, to this day. And in fact, we succeeded in selling it to the Air Force, and first of all, Rand was very suspicious, what are these social science characters up to? And then they saw that this came out they thought, now that's something imaginative, it makes sense, it isn't starry-eyed, it isn't too software-ish. They liked it. even the skeptics with regard to social science liked it in Rand, and also the Air Force liked it. In fact, it was used in some modified form, I forget now which form, but it was used during the Korean War. This was very important in establishing the social science division within RAND and within the Air Force.
Did you brief this study to the Air Force?
I forget.
Did your staff?
I forget. I think it was briefed. I'm almost certain it was. I know that it was briefed to the trustees, and I briefed the trustees very often. For some reason or other, Frankfurt, I was good at that. And I did it very often, that I talked to the trustees, much too often, I thought. And I did it there, and it impressed them a great deal. In fact, one of the trustees, whose name escapes me, told me that the same principle was used by the British in suppressing uprisings in their colonial areas in the 19th century, or the beginning of the, not 19th century, beginning of the, air age, or maybe it was even used in the form that they should surrender some rebellious chiefs, otherwise their village would be destroyed, or something of the sort. But in any case, warning before the action was taken was the same principle. It was used in British colonial administration, and this man, this trustee, knew a great deal about that and added this as an input to the study. It had been used, the same principle. So yes, I briefed the trustees on the subject. Now, that was one study. Then the other study was Airborne and Emotional Stress by Janice in Yale, psychologist in Yale, who did a very good piece of work on the subject, I thought. Then that is available as a book, published, I think, in 59, before that, in the 50s. Very early. I could give you the exact date if you want to.
You can fill that in later.
Yeah. Another early study was by Selznick on the so-called organizational weapon. That was an individual piece of work, too. Selznick was a sociologist who had the idea that to study Bolshevik tactics and policies in times of peace, so-called, Cold War, it's important to see how they use organizations in the target country to do their work for them. Bookstores distributing material and other parties, how they manage them, and so on and so forth. And he called it the organizational weapon, and it was quite a good book. Unfortunately, Selznick left us later, and it's the only major piece of work that he did. Well, he liked it very much at Rand, and he considered Ketch Committee, Paul Ketch Committee, as a typical European intellectual. He said he never knew what it was, but now he had met one, namely Ketch Committee, who was quite an extraordinary person himself. I said, but why do you want to leave if you like some of the people, you like the work? He says, I'll tell you why I want to leave. It is too strenuous for me. I said, I don't understand you. He says, the expectations are so high. You always have to produce. I said, you don't always have to produce. You have to work at it, yes. But, that was of no avail. He wanted to be in a calmer environment. It was too overheated, he felt. And So he left us, unfortunately. He was with us for quite a while, but then a few years. Then he went to Berkeley and became a sociologist there and wrote a textbook and made a million on it, really. Became a millionaire on a textbook. That was possible even then. And that he couldn't have become at Rand, and that was not his intention when he left. He left, I think he was telling me the truth when he said that he felt it was too hectic, life at Rand. Well, that was Selznick's book. Then we instituted a whole program of Soviet studies, not only the organizational weapons, but Leitis's work, and then there was work on done primarily by Dinnerstein and Gouret on Soviet military doctrine. Gouret is G-O-U-R-E, accent aigu. It's Gourevitch originally. He was, I think, Russian by birth. Gouret and Dinnerstein is D-I-N-E-R-S-T-E-I-N. They both wrote on Soviet military doctrine and things like that. Now, then I made it a rule in trying, and when I started hiring people, not only that they should all have had some government experience. This was shortly after the war, after all, and most of them had. In fact, all of them had. All of them I can think of had some government experience in some organization for the, in Washington or abroad. And that was one prerequisite. Another prerequisite was that they should be, if possible, if at all possible, should be an area specialist on one particular area. That is, which implied that they should speak the language of the country they were interested in. I once made a count, head count, and found out that there were more languages spoken in the social science division than there were people. That's pretty good. And indeed, I mean, we had people who spoke Scandinavian languages and French, of course, and by speaking, I mean speaking, writing, and understanding, including writing. And why was this important? I felt it was important that in the cases where we could visit the country, that we should establish contact with the leading groups in the country, representative of the leading political parties, of the government, of the publishers, of the business people, and so on and so forth. this was done in France. This was done in Germany, where I myself did a great deal of field work with respect to the military elite. I talked to practically every important German general in World War II. In the post-war period, about the question of German rearmament and the requirements of the defense of NATO. And to all the important politicians of all parties. And in addition to that, we organized, and I personally organized, a great deal of many, many travels of German important people. Deputies in the parliament, foreign minister, defense minister, some clerical personnel, I mean high bishop. Once we had visit by a cardinal and his entourage to come, diplomats, ambassadors, and so on, to come to Rand, look this place over, give a lecture, discuss with us what was of interest to them and to us. And it was, in some cases, the it led to even lasting friendships. Some editor, it was one of the generals who has died in the meantime, and in some cases it led to minor disasters. I once invited Weizsäcker, the physicist, to come to Rand, whom I had known, and he came. And he was the head of a very important research organization at the time in Munich or so, or in Hamburg, I forget where. And so I said, well, if you come, why don't you discuss your research project with us? Because you are a scientist and we are scientists, so there would be an interest in the subject, what you do in Germany. He was the most important atomic physicist in Germany at the time, still surviving. Very much against atomic war and atomic weapons. So he gave a talk. This was already after Frank, under his successor. And I made the rounds. I forget now what's his name. He's now at Stanford.
Henry Rowan?
Yes, Henry Rowan. I went to Henry Rowan and said he should also attend it. I asked the division chiefs to come and had a small group of distinguished Rendites listen to this talk. So he talked about his intentions, what he wants to do in the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaft, I think it was called. and he had a very ambitious program. I was the chairman, and it was Rand practice that is after the presentation is a discussion. And once the president of the organization is there, it's only polite on the part of the chairman to ask this president of the organization to have the first word. So I asked Henry, do you wish to make a comment, initial comment, now that we open the discussion? And so Henry Rowan said, yes, I do. Mr. Weizsäcker, he said, he called him. You have told us what you want to do. Now tell us, please, what you don't want to do. And I was dead silence, you know. He was simply overwhelmed by the, and he thought it was an insult to Rand to think that he can do all this. And to, instead of talking sense, he wanted to shine in this glory of his organization, all these projects. And so I had a very tough time as a chairman to save the situation. I said something to the effect that we were also terribly impressed by the ambitiousness of his program and so on, that he must understand and the frankness of a discussion that is customary in Rand and so on and so forth, that this question would be raised. In fact, it was foreseeable that it would be raised, and tried to get people to laugh and so on, but it was awful. It just was absolutely awful. On the whole, however, we had some very good results with this policy of trying to get foreigners to come and talk to us. We also had Britishers there. We had people from Japan, from whenever possible. We organized close contact, used to have close contacts with people who are interested in foreign policy and knowledgeable on foreign policy and military affairs. And we laid our cards open on the table as far as we could do it without violating secrecy, different from Mr. Ellsberg, and told them what we were thinking and what interested us. And they were interested in how we cooperated with the universities, how we recruited people, how the places run, how our salary schedules are set, and so they were terribly interested in the whole thing.
Just like me.
Yeah, sure. Sure. And this made for a very good rapport. You see, when you went back to, let's say, Germany or so, the first few times it was complicated, but then you just made the rounds, as it were. You always saw the same people, or you got handed on to another person, and so on. Now, as far as the German work is concerned, this resulted in two books. One was a collective volume, symposium volume on German leadership and foreign policy, something like that. And discuss the government elite and the political parties and the trade unions and the various organizations that had an impact on German foreign policy. And the second volume was I wrote myself alone on the, which is called German Rearmament and Atomic War, which was the reported the results of the visit with the generals and the military affairs. And I had some roundtable discussions on anxiety in Germany of air attack and civil defense problems and so on and so forth. In France, it resulted in a book which Leitis wrote again with together with a parliamentary secretary of some party in France on the House Without Windows, very intricate French practices in forming governments and forming policy and so on. It's very insightful also on French policy.
So, in other words, you were encouraging collaborative ventures between RAND staff members and people in other countries.
Yes, too. Yes, yes. Just as we were encouraging collaborative efforts in this country with universities, and we gave also to promote this. We gave stipends without any conditions attached to it to certain universities. You decide, you the faculty decide who should get it and just tell us what you did with the money. It should be used for graduate research. That was a description of it. Not in this field or in that field or of military interest or not. Just support research. Initiative, the only foreign university who got this was Berlin, the Free University of Berlin. Got it for a couple of years, also for several years, not a couple, 3 or 4 years. Still at the beginning of the Vietnam War, they got it. So and so much money, and we hardly knew whom it was given to. I think Rand didn't even keep a list of the people whom it was given to. We just gave it to the university, and it was Columbia got one, I think Chicago, stipend and so on. This plus the, made arrangements with universities for work that was done by a Randite, by some person in Rand, that if the work was finished, it might be considered by the university, not by us, but by the university, as meeting the requirements for the doctoral dissertation, for a doctoral dissertation. And that's the way, for example, Alex George got his doctorate degree from Chicago. Another person, Phil Davison, Mrs. Davison, not Davidson, Davison. Phil is with double L. W. Phillips Davison, who is now a professor at Columbia, if he is not retired by now. he wrote a book on the Berlin blockade, on the airlift, the Berlin blockade, because our notion was that the Air Force is an organization, as all military organizations are, that can be used in peacetime for advancing policy objectives. And just as you can advance policy objective by naval maneuvers or by mobilization or by sending a few people to Panama, what have you. So you can also use an airlift to save a city, which was done. It's probably the greatest peaceful and greatest humanitarian mission ever performed by any military organization. In any case, we had the idea, and Phil Davison was interested in doing it, of studying this, what had happened there. And by studying this from a social science point of view, we always had the rule, try to create data, not only use them as they are given to you. By creating data meant in this case, for example, go around and interview people about their memories of the airlift, get students in schools to write essays and make money available for the best essay on my memories of the airlift for children. On the same thing in a newspaper, get people to write in letters about the memories of the airlift and so on and so forth. And the book contains a great deal of material not to be found anywhere else about what it meant to the Berliners to have the airlift. Now, I submit that this was a good social science study. And in fact, it was translated into German, and it did create a great deal of goodwill in Germany that we did this and were interested in the Berliners and so on, helped also to dispel some of the notion of RAND being a warmongering organization, which was held in some quarters and which bothered me a little. And so I tried to keep this in mind in deciding on new projects. I don't think we have ever worked in any kind of a warmongering subject in the social science division. We certainly did work on the Soviet Union, where I personally was very much interested in atomic blackmail. I think I was the one who invented the phrase before Eisenhower used it in the 50s. And followed this in the case of the war in the Middle East, in the case of Khrushchev's career, who tried to intimidate all the NATO allies there would be no Acropolis left, he told the Greeks, and there will be Britain will be one vast cemetery, and so on. This was the way he talked about NATO and tried to undermine the solidarity of NATO. So we studied these techniques. I particularly studied this. I wrote also an essay on Soviet atomic blackmail, which became sort of well known in RAND, at least. And all right. So, but was one more thing though. Are you through with this?
I'm at the end of the tape. Why don't we go over here and flip over?
Yeah.